Before I get to the questions, let me ask, if I can, Bart Gellman on Snowden. You got the information for Snowden, and I don't know how many documents. I mean, I guess one estimate is there's 1.7 million documents that he took. You know, it's been gradually coming out. But you had a chance to sit with him. You had a chance to talk with him. Give me your impressions about what makes this guy tick. Why did he do what he did?
He's given a pretty clear public account of why he did what he did. And it's always important to me to know what someone's motives are, who's giving me information or who's talking to me. I don't actually care what the motives are. I'm not making a judgment about whether they're good or bad. What I care about is whether I'm getting information that seems to me to be important and that is verifiable, that is authenticatable, that I can place in context and that I think I should publish. But I do need to know why someone's doing what he or she does so that I can check those things. I can check for bias. I can check for context. I can look for places where I think that person has an axe to grind. He has plenty of axes to grind. He's made them very clear. He believes that the U.S. government has accumulated far more power than is consistent with democratic self-government, that it is that it represents a risk to Americans, that decisions have been made in secret that the American people obviously didn't know about and might not approve of. If they did know, and that he thought that there was no other way that he could promote the public debate he was hoping to create. Now, it's not for me to judge him. I'm the last person you should ask to judge him because I have a relationship of him to him of a reporter, a source. So you should feel free to judge his conduct and character as you wish, and he needs to be held accountable one way or another for his actions. I actually think a much more interesting question is holding accountable the U.S. government for what it's doing. If I have a choice of looking into the behavior of a big, powerful institution or one individual, I tend to be a little more interested in the institution.
Let me I have a question along those lines, which was, do you believe Snowden did the right thing to bring up the topic on surveillance and privacy? And if not, what other way could he have gone about doing this? We at an earlier session, we talked about whistleblower and what other available paths he could have taken without dumping all of this secret information out there. So, did he do the right thing, and were there other ways to get it done? Bob?
There are ways to do these things. My problem is that we are a representative democracy. There are some secrets that need to be kept secret. As Bart indicated earlier, the programs that at issue had been debated long and hard before Congress, or in Congress, so we are representatives in making these decisions in terms of balancing the civil liberties versus the necessity for having a program that protects us. And in this particular case, Congress not only initiated the legislation that set up the capabilities, but also when it came up for renewal, had a substantial debate as to whether it should be renewed and determined to renew it. My problem with individuals, put Snowden aside, is taking into their own hands the decision to release information on it, and there's no going back. All of a sudden, that individual is making a decision, and it's not our representatives. And I have a firm belief in the oversight capability of Congress. Heaven knows, Mike and I have spent a fair amount of time before Congress, but that's the way our country is set up, and I have comfort and confidence in them doing the right thing. Secondly, we, as I said, uniquely in the United States have a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. In just about every other country around the world, the head of the FBI or a comparable agency can sign off on a warrant to get an interception. And we are unique. And that uniqueness has not necessarily been talked about much in the press, but it does give FISA court, the third branch of government, the right to opine itself as to the legality and necessity for the particular programs. So my concern comes in arrogating to himself, or oneself, the decision to disclose, whereas I do believe there are mechanisms there that where it has been and could additionally have been subject to further debate.
Mike? We simply cannot have a system in which individuals get to make a decision as to what is secret and as what is not. We simply can't. This risks setting a precedent, depending on what happens to Mr. Snowden and depending on how what the perceptions of him ultimately are, creates a risk that others will follow suit and disclose what they think needs to be disclosed. It also strikes me that Mr. Snowden did not only disclose information relating to the privacy and civil liberties of Americans or even foreign private citizens, but he disclosed a lot of information about other intelligence programs that had nothing to do with privacy and civil liberties. And then the last thing I'd say about Mr. Snowden, since I'm on a roll here, the last thing I'd say is he believed that the American people should be the judge of these programs. If he really believes that, then shouldn't he also believe that the American people should be the judge of his actions in this regard? And doesn't that mean he should come home and be judged by the American people? Maybe they'll say, fine. Maybe a jury will say, fine, we think you did the right thing, walk free. But he can't believe one thing and not believe the other. I'm sorry.
Bart?
Okay. See, now I know why I'm on this panel. If Snowden comes back and makes his case to the American people, here's how it goes. The elements of the crime are that he had lawful access to classified information and he gave it to someone who didn't have lawful access to it. If you meet those two elements, you're convicted. He's not allowed to introduce any public interest defense. He's not allowed to say why he did it, what benefit he thinks accrued from it. If the Supreme Court were to rule systematically that every single program that he disclosed was unconstitutional, he would still be convicted. So you could think that he ought to come back and do what the classic civil disobedience, just say, I know I crossed a line, I did it for what I think is a good cause, I'm ready to take the consequences. But don't pretend that he could come back here and have an actual sort of debate or participate in an actual debate about whether what he did was right or wrong. He would simply be put in jail.
No, he'd be tried. And a decision would be made about his guilt, and then a decision would be made about his punishment, right? And he could be found guilty for committing a crime, and there could be no punishment because the jury believed that the good of what he did outweighed the negative. So I do not believe
that the former prosecutor on this panel would support the idea that he would be allowed to introduce evidence of that kind at all. In any event, there was another part of the question. Remind me what that was.
The other question was there not another way he could have done this than the approach he took of just dumping this out? Could he have gone to some of the key people on the Hill or the IG and basically expressed his concerns to them without dumping all of the secret information out there?
There was a whole system set up, and just one more time, because it gets repeated all the time in public, but it doesn't. This question is not addressed. Most of what he disclosed is not under the jurisdiction of the FISA court, and the FISA court does not know about it. Most of what he disclosed gets a very small amount of attention from Congress, because Congress does not principally oversee operations under 12333, the executive order that governs foreign intelligence gathering overseas, and this is what the chairman of the committee has said. So most of what we're talking about is stuff that did not get overseen by another branch of government. He is taking issue fundamentally with policy decisions and operations that are taken for granted inside the world of the agencies and inside the world of the system that does oversee them. You can't go to your boss or your boss's boss or the people overseeing them in any entity in the universe and say, good God, look at what you're doing. The entire operation you're undertaking is wrong. You're crossing all kinds of lines. He wasn't saying there's an abuse here or an abuse there. He was saying that there are fundamental choices being made about how we govern ourselves that they are not entitled to make without more direct public approval. And one last thing. There is highly classified information that is disclosed in Washington to news organizations every single day of the year, and put into, and I won't get any dispute. I'm almost sure of this from anybody on this stage, that almost all of it comes from government officials who are in some way or another either quasi-authorized or authorized, but not lawfully allowed to disclose it. So it's not so much from either of these two, the former agencies that these guys represent, although it happens, but from departments across the federal government. You have mid-level officials and senior officials and assistants to senior officials telling people classified information. Because almost everything to do with our foreign policy or our defense policy that is not in a press conference and not in public testimony is classified. That's just the nature of the thing. And in fact, Washington would grind to a halt. That we actually could not govern ourselves if there were not back channel conversations of this kind. And most of it comes from the White House or from people working as they see it on behalf of the White House, but without lawful authority to make the disclosure.
Go ahead, Mike. Say something. The one thing we haven't mentioned here is the damage done by these disclosures. You know, we've talked about, isn't it great that the public is debating this for the first time, and isn't that a good thing? But that has come at a significant cost. Even before I left government, which was only 2 months after the first disclosures, I personally saw terrorist organizations change the way they communicate because of these disclosures. And now it is more difficult to collect intelligence on them and more likely that they will be successful in conducting an attack. So that's just one of the implications here on the downside of what Ed Snowden decided to do when he took matters into his own hands.
Well, in line with that, Bart, the question is, did it concern you that the information you were revealing could hurt our national security?
Concerns me immensely every day, and I don't take this question lightly. I don't think there are easy lines to draw. I have made clear, because I felt that I had an obligation to do so in stories, that I've held back a considerable amount of what I know, considerable amount of what, even in the very first story I wrote, which is about PRISM, the PRISM program, which is collection from the nine large U.S.-based internet companies of content information.
Pursuant to court order.
That's right. Pursuant to a court programmatic order in which the
classified
once the court
classified says, court orders.
Yes. Right. So to the extent you're raising the question about Snowden or blaming him for making disclosures, let's not pretend that I'm not a big part of this. He didn't put stuff in the Washington Post. I did, and the Washington Post made the decisions about where to draw the lines. And I am very much concerned about disclosing too much. There are things in the documents which are obvious to me should not be made public, having to do with particular targets, having to do with particular discoveries, having to do with particular operational techniques, that the disclosure of which would end the program. That's not our intent. Our intent is to put on the table questions about whether certain kinds of operations should be allowed, where the rules should be, without deciding it in advance by means of our disclosure. So it's not only a question of what I hold back. I'm not doing this as sort of armchair pretend national security expert. I am consulting with the responsible agencies of government in every story. I made a promise that to the government that I would give them a minimum of 2 days' notice and a full accounting of every single fact that I intended to publish. And usually it's been more than that. And we've had conversations as detailed as they wanted to make them of what the stakes were. And almost every one of those conversations ended in a way that was mutually satisfactory. Not that anyone in the U.S. government is comfortable with the idea that we're publishing secrets, but the conversations tend to end as if you carry out your agreement that you are not going to publish this or this, and if you do it the way you said you're going to do it, we're not going to take this conversation past you up to your editor. I mean, we know what it looks like when the government really cares. You know what it looks like. You've seen it. You've done it. The government really cares about a story being published. It goes all the way to the top. And it has not done so in any of these stories.
Okay. Turning to another kind of present issue, Benghazi. Obviously, the House committee is, they've now appointed a committee that will investigate it again. We'll determine whether Democrats participate in it or not. Principal accusation was that the White House deliberately misled the American people with talking points in order to protect the president from the accusation that he was weak on terrorism. And I guess, Michael, you were involved with the talking points. Was there any truth to that accusation as far as you know? And if not, why is these memos from Ben Rhodes and talking points why were they aimed at stressing the video as opposed to the attack?
So it's very important to remember here that there's actually two sets of talking points now. For months there was only one set of talking points, and now there's two. The only set of talking points that I was ever aware of was the set that the CIA produced at the request of Congress. And those were produced by my analysts, and they were edited by a number of people, including me. One of the accusations that is made is that the intelligence community, the CIA, my officers, myself, edited those talking points for the political benefit of the President of the United States and for the then Secretary of State. There is absolutely no truth to that, and I am 100% confident that when this committee is done with its work, that will be shown to be true. The second set of talking points, which is the White House's talking points for Susan Rice for the Sunday shows, nobody in the intelligence community vetted those. Nobody in the intelligence community was aware of those. So I just learned about those a couple weeks ago. So I really don't have anything to add on those points. The ones I can talk to are the ones that we produced.
There have been a number of investigations. What's your position with regards to another investigation?
So there's been investigations by the Senate Intelligence Committee, the House Intelligence Committee, the House Armed Services Committee. I think the House Government Oversight Committee, number of investigations. The State Department did its own accountability review board, led by Tom Pickering and Admiral Mullen, two great Americans. So a number of investigations and studies. I've testified four times on Benghazi. Three times in closed session and once more recently in public session. So a lot of people have looked at this. But the polls show that the American people still have questions. I want to make sure that all of those questions are cleared up. There's still some questions about the role of the agency, and there's still questions about my own personal role, and I want to clear that up. So might be surprising for you to hear me say this, but I am a supporter of the creation of this committee because I want all the facts to come together in one place and be presented as one, by one entity, as one thing, so the American people can see all of this. And I think when that happens, unless politics takes over, I'm hopeful that at least getting the facts on the table will be helpful.
Bob, can I ask, without getting anything that you can't discuss, but one of the arguments has been why we have not brought any of these individuals to justice in terms of those that were involved in the Benghazi attack. Can you speak to that at all?
Well, an ongoing investigation when I my term was over. We'd done interviews around the world, not just in Libya, but Libya is a very, very difficult place to operate, at very little security. We couldn't get into the crime scene as early as we would have wanted to for those reasons. But what I can say, it's an active investigation, and beyond that, the fruits of that investigation, where they are not public. But I can assure you that everything is being done to make certain those persons responsible for the deaths. Deaths of the ambassador and the other three others, and the other three, is ongoing, and all resources are being put into it.
I mean, it's fair to say. I mean, when I was at DOD, it was we had at least identified who some of the main culprits were. At that point, right?
We had some idea as to who was involved. Yes.
Yeah.
It took us 10 years to get Bin Laden in a very difficult operating environment, and I would argue Libya is even more of a difficult operating environment than Pakistan was.
Bart, question here. What are the greatest threats to freedom of the press in this country? Pretty broad question, but you would probably know the answer.
I don't know. If y'all stop buying newspapers. I am not a dramatist or alarmist about freedom of the press in this country. The government has tolerated a diversity of debate and the disclosure of things that many other governments would have used sort of every instrument of their power to prevent. I do not feel personally threatened, even when I write very controversial stories. There have been a lot more leak investigations that bring to bear the power of the criminal law against the leakers and the potential for civil compulsion against the journalists who receive the leaks. And so you have some quite serious issues raised that way. You have Jim Risen of the New York Times, who is now getting close to exhausting his final appeal on an order to disclose his confidential source for one of the chapters in his book. And he has said that he would rather go to jail than disclose that. And so, we may be in a position of watching the jailing of American journalists for declining to give up a confidential source. And without confidential sources, we can't do hugely important parts of our work. All that being said, this is, among the very few least oppressive places on the planet Earth to do the kind of work I do, and I'm just not going to join in with the voices who say there's some great danger at the moment.
Okay. Mike, what is the decision-making process and ethics surrounding drone strikes and the unforeseen consequences?
I think the ethics are pretty clear. I think the ethics involve when you have an individual or group of individuals who you know through credible multiple streams of intelligence are trying to attack the United States, have the capability to do so, and you're not in a position to capture them. And the only way that you can end that threat is to kill them with a drone strike, you have a responsibility as President of the United States to do that. To protect the country. There's no question in my mind that it's ethical. It's as ethical as a sniper on a battlefield shooting an enemy combatant a mile away. There is no difference. I will tell you that the drone strikes that have been conducted by the United States have been extremely effective in degrading parts of the al-Qaeda organization, the most dangerous parts of the al-Qaeda organization. And there is little doubt in my mind that the drone strikes conducted by the United States between 2008 and 2011, 2012, prevented another 9/11 style attack against this country. I will also tell you that the claims of excessive collateral damage are not true. They are propaganda by al-Qaeda. They are propaganda by some other organizations that want to undercut the program. And they're simple mistakes by reporters and people who look into this. For example, I'll give you a really simple example. Some of the people looking into drone strikes will go talk to the parents of the people who were killed, and they will ask, was your son a terrorist? And the parents will say, no, of course my son was not a terrorist. That person gets put down as collateral damage. I will tell you that, this is true. I will tell you that this is the most precise weapon in the arsenal. I will tell you collateral damage is much less than with any other weapon system that the United States uses.
Bob, as director of the FBI, were you concerned about the potential of a cyber attack in this country?
Absolutely. I mean, for a long time, we believe that the cyber arena will be as much of a challenge as the, and if not more of a challenge in some senses, than the war on terror, counterterrorism. We face a number of threats, the hacktivists, they call it, Anonymous, LulzSec, and the like, who will invade computers, criminals. If I ask for a show of hands here, the numbers of individuals who shopped at Target during that period of time this year, probably half the hands in this auditorium would go up, and most of you have had to get new credit cards. Cyber attacks in the form of stealing intellectual property, sure, the military and the like, but many corporations now face that. The threat of a cyber attack by terrorists on the infrastructure or on the exchanges is a huge issue. And the use of cyber now by the military, the Russians, for instance, in Georgia, before they sent the tanks in to disable disable command and control. All of these are areas of concern for us, not only in the Bureau, but in the agency and others. We have recognized this for 8-10 years. We've hired to make certain we have the skills and the capabilities. But as somewhat differently than the war on terror domestically, our greatest partner in the war on terror domestically was state and local law enforcement, and we have more than 100 joint terrorism task forces in which persons are participating. But in the cyber arena, it's really the private sector that has much of the intelligence in terms of being the victims. And what we have to, in order to be successful here, as we were in the war on terror, we need to harness the capabilities of the private sector, the victims, and have a mechanism for exchanging the information with regard to cyber attacks to the federal side. And on the federal side, we have to do a better job of consolidating the information and putting it out to the victims. The most serious attack, which presages what is going to happen in the future, is I think it was 2012. Aramco, the oil company, suffered what's called a wiper virus, and 30,000 hard drives were erased as a result of this virus. So it's not denial of service attacks where you can't get on the website. It's not the extraction of information. It is going in and disabling and wiping out information that is the next stage we have to be aware of. And I think if you're going to have a panel such as this 2-3 years down the road, it will be focused principally on this particular threat.
What countries are the greatest threats in terms of a cyber attack?
Well, I think...
Towards the United States.
Identified publicly by Bandiat in the report last year, it was quite obvious, the Chinese, the Russians, I think elsewhere publicly, Iranians. We have... part of the problem is attributing an attack to a particular country, on the one hand, China, Russia, or what have you, or to organized crime operating out of actually Ukraine or Romania or Russia, or the 18-year-old who's sitting up in his bedroom, somewhat proficient in terms of hacking capabilities, one of the biggest denial of service attacks here in the Northern District of California was back in, I think, 2000, where this one 18-year-old up in Canada shut down eBay, E-Trade, Global Crossing. There are a bunch of companies. And it's a kid, 18 years old, who used the name of Mafia Boy on the Internet. So part of your problem is you don't know at the outset whether it's a country, organized crime, or that 18-year-old who you have to go after, which complicates the issue.
Mark, do you want to comment?
Right, so as the director said, mentioning, I mean, when you talk about sort of cybersecurity, cyber threat, cyber attack, you're describing a very broad spectrum of operations or of things that happen in the world, from sort of defacing a website and denying service to stealing information to actually trying to destroy information to actually trying to use cyber means to produce kinetic results in the world, do actual physical damage. And the preeminent example of that latter is an operation that was conducted by the United States government against Iran. It's the Stuxnet attack, which has yet to be officially acknowledged by the U.S. government. But if you were to believe media reports, which led to massive investigations for the leak of classified information, then it was the U.S. government acting in concert with Israel that used cyber means to destroy a centrifuge array in Iran that was being used to enrich uranium. And you know, I would bet a lot of people in this room would think that, supposing that's true, that was a good thing, that you would like to see. You don't want to see the Iranian nuclear program growing, but part of the problem with the debate about cyber security is that I think it's now fairly clearly demonstrable that the most capable sort of cyber actor on the planet is the United States government. That we now know that without actually an open debate in Congress or in public, the U.S. government has decided to launch quite a large number of offensive cyber operations. That if the threat is stealing information, we do a lot of that. If the threat is interfering with other countries' operations, we do a lot of that. You can say we're the good guys, and that's fine, and it's not good for them because they're the bad guys, and I might agree with you in lots of cases. But I don't think we should pretend that this is just a thing that happens to us. I mean, the general counsel of Microsoft, you know, sort of some hundreds of miles up the road here, said that what the U.S. government, what the NSA was doing to the Silicon Valley companies was akin to an advanced persistent threat, which is the typical sort of invective word you use for Chinese operations that plant these long-term bugs.
If I can hold you there, there's an awful lot of issues here to discuss, and we haven't touched on half of the issues that are out there. But I think you get the flavor that this issue of security versus freedom and what we do to protect ourselves at the same time, how do we ensure that our rights are protected, is an important debate for this country to have. And it goes to what our Constitution is all about. But I think in the end, the real decision as to how we balance those two rests with all of you in this audience. And your ability not only to vote on these issues, but to ensure that we always maintain the proper balance in protecting our freedoms and at the same time protecting our country. Please thank all of our speakers and thank you.